from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On Tuesday, the United States officially recognized the Syrian Opposition Coalition as the legitimate representative of the Syrian people against President Bashar al-Assad. In return, the group said it wanted real support with weapons and military aid. How involved should the United States get in Syria, and could America's support turn the tide for the fighting against the Assad government? Or is it simply too little too late, as a number of Syrian groups say? Joining us to discuss the recent announced position on Syria of the Obama administration in studio is Fred Lawson. He's professor of government and government department head at Mills College, also editor of the book Demystifying Syria and author of upcoming Global Security Watch. Let's say that right, Global Security Watch Syria. Professor Lawson, good to have you with
Thank
us.
Thank you. Morning.
Morning. We also have Amer al-Azam with us, and Amer al-Azam is Associate Professor of Middle East History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio, and we welcome you to the program as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. I'm going to begin with Fred Lawson here in studio. Well, the new news on this, I want to get, of course, to the United States position, but the new news is Scuds being fired into near Damascus by the Assad regime. There may be a red line in the sand as far as chemical weaponry, but this is pretty extraordinary to shoot Scuds at in your own country.
It really is. And it shows, I think, that even the Syrian regime thinks now that the uprising has come pretty close to the capital, that the rebellion is gaining ground and gaining momentum.
Well, in fact, they're getting close to Damascus, aren't they?
I think they are getting to Damascus. Some of the suburbs of Damascus have been deeply involved in the uprising from the very beginning. There's an important suburb that has been pretty much under opposition control for about a year now. But other parts of Damascus have been unscathed by the fighting up to this point. And so there's a real disjunction between some neighborhoods where life has gone on almost without change and other neighborhoods that have been destroyed by shelling and bombing.
So what does this mean in the grand scheme of things, Professor Amer al-Azam, especially vis-a-vis the civil war? I mean, now that the United States and along with France and England and Turkey have come down against the Assad regime, or at least with the opposition, is it going to help the effort of the opposition? Is it going to make it sooner that they can really be victorious against Assad?
Well, I mean, look, the collapse of the regime has always been inevitable. The question was always, how long is it going to take and what is the cost? I think that's the critical point. What is the cost of this process? And that is also the concern of many of us, both as Syrians and the international community, because if the cost is too high, you may also bring down the state with it. And if you bring down the state, if you destroy the country, you essentially create all sorts of problems, and the blowback from that into the neighboring countries such as Lebanon, Syria, Turkey, Iraq, and so on and so forth could be quite significant. I think the reason why the international community has now, if you want, upped the ante and recognized the Syrian opposition is because now we're at this juncture where, as Fred and yourselves quite rightly pointed out, there are some significant gains being made on the ground. The regime is increasingly on the back foot, and it's now using more and more extreme weapons, which, again, are indications of being strained to the very extreme. But you also need to bring the regime to a point where it will agree to negotiate a way out of this, because you don't want the final outcome to be a military one, because that would be very destructive. And so you also need an opposition that is ready, that is legitimized, that has the ability to, in essence, negotiate when the right time comes with the regime for the transition process.
And those who are negotiating are not necessarily those who represent the fighting forces. I mean, there is a split there as well, isn't there?
Oh, yes, but no, but let me tell you this. I mean, when we talk about negotiation, we don't necessarily mean two things have to be said here. One, the negotiations are not negotiations with Assad himself. He has to go. Negotiation is with the remainder of the regime, over the transition of how do we basically get over the Assad and into the next phase. But also in terms of anyone who's negotiating on the part of the opposition has to also speak for the military elements within that are doing the fighting. Otherwise, how is it that, if, let's say, if I'm on the regime side and I'm negotiating, I want to make sure that what agreement I make with you is going to be upheld. If I have no control over the military, or if the military guys basically turn around and say, well, we're not accepting this, then you know, the whole thing falls apart.
Well, let's talk about this opposition, because, Fred Lawson, you got over 100 anti-government groups and organizations actually ready to demonstrate on Friday against American involvement, and also behind Jihad al-Nusra, which is the Arabic name for the Nusra Front, the front that apparently somehow in the Obama administration's mind is no longer a part of the opposition, but there they are supporting that group. And that and a lot of the momentum now has been strong Islamist groups.
And as Professor Al-Azam says, there's a wide range of military groups engaged in the uprising. Some of these groups are pretty much self-defense forces. They're neighborhood organizations or village organizations just trying to defend the local population. Other groups have organized with a little broader mission and have become part of this Free Syrian Army that is mostly based in Turkey but has been operating in the north part of the country. And then there are the militant radical Islamist organizations. These organizations have very fragile relations with the Free Syrian Army. They're probably fighting for very different causes. They involve very different kinds of people. And as Professor Al-Azam says, even if the Syrian opposition can promise that the Free Syrian Army will abide by a ceasefire, there's no telling what the militant Islamist groups might do. This assistance front that you mentioned, the Jabhat al-Nusra, probably played a key role in undermining the ceasefire at the last major holiday in the late summer, and just shows that this organization is going its own way and has an agenda very different from that of the broad opposition.
And there are al-Qaeda links. I mean, there's no mistaking that in terms of the opposition and some of those who are now behind the opposition. Some are saying, in fact, those al-Qaeda links, many of those jihadis, were the reason that the momentum started moving even more in the direction of overthrowing Assad.
I think that's probably true. We will let Amr comment on this. I've been trying to look to see if the Assistance Front has ever itself claimed to be part of al-Qaeda, and I didn't quite see that, but I'm willing to be corrected.
How do you see it, Professor Al-Azam?
Well, let me tell you this. Jabhat al-Nusra and these other sort of more radical Islamist groups, a lot of them actually were part of the Iraq-Syria network back when the insurgency was going on in Iraq, and the traffic was basically from Syria across the borders into Nineveh, into Anbar, and these networks were had become basically very well established going from Syria into Iraq. And what we've seen now is essentially a reversal back from Iraq into Syria. It's, you know, what goes one way can easily come back the other way, and in a way has come back home to roost, and basically the regime is now sowing in part reaping what it sowed during the Iraq insurgency years. And we know that these groups have al-Qaeda links, even if they don't necessarily say it themselves, but we know because of their connections, because of what they did in Iraq, that they do have al-Qaeda, and therefore it's very likely that they are al-Qaeda, if not affiliated per se in a formal manner, but they certainly are very well linked to al-Qaeda, and as such, you know, are quite a significant threat.
Well, a lot of those al-Qaeda fighters or whatever radical Islamists who were fighting in Iraq were also coming out of Libya. Now, notwithstanding what happened in Benghazi, we have it appears to be a democratic government. The problem here seems to be that a lot of this opposition is sort of saying too little, too late from the United States. There's a great deal of anger at the United States for not coming in earlier, isn't there?
Yes, there is, and unfortunately, there's a narrative that is now going around, and it's a very unfortunate narrative, and it was a predictable narrative, because when, if you think about it, the Syrian people sort of started their uprising, and then they turned around to the international community, to the United States, and said, "Help us, like you have helped others, like you've helped in most recently the Libyans." And when, of course, this help was not forthcoming, and there are many reasons why this did not happen, basically, people started to find their own interpretation, and their interpretation is, well, if you're not not helping us, it means you're not really against the Assad regime. You really want it there. And then by default, the next explanation is, well, the reason why you want him there is because it protects Israel's interests. And, you know, with the whole Arab-Israeli conflict and the issue with Syria and Israel, it makes perfect sense for someone who is of that mindset that because the Assad regime never, you know, maintained a border with Israel that had no attacks or no cross-border attacks, at least in there's this narrative that now sets in that says, well, the Israelis prefer the Assads because they have maintained this safe border, and therefore the Americans want the Assads there really in truth because of that. And of course, it's a false narrative. It's not true. It's not the case. But this narrative has now started to take root, and it's going to be very difficult to, you know, kind of change that, given the fact that the U.S. administration, even to this day, is still very, very shy about dealing with the Syrian situation.
Well, there were no airstrikes. There was no fly zones, no arms put into, at least that we know of. There may have been lots behind the scenes. Yeah.
Yes, there is stuff going on behind the scenes.
But indeed, in terms of the United States official position, and Fred Lawson, also, the United States doesn't recognize the right of this opposition to access Syrian government funds, or to take over D.C., Washington, D.C.-based embassy of Syria, or, for that matter, enter into binding agreements of any kind, commitments.
Well, we now have this new organization, this new national coalition of Syrian revolutionary and opposition forces that was founded in November in Qatar and was founded very much at the instigation and with the encouragement of the United States. The Obama administration charged rather unexpectedly in October that the old Syrian National Council was unrepresentative and ineffective. The Obama administration was probably also worried that the Syrian National Council was so heavily influenced by the Muslim Brothers. And so U.S. officials put a good deal of pressure on various opposition forces to form this new organization. This new organization is a little broader. It includes a little more representatives of different currents of the opposition from the old Syrian National Council. And so the United States is pretty much stuck with having to recognize it, since the U.S. played a major part in putting it together. But nevertheless, the new national coalition still seems to have a good deal of distance between itself and fighters on the ground, and a good deal of suspicion on the part of civil rights activists inside Syria, who are worried that any outside group is going to be branded with cooperating with foreigners.
Fred Lawson, professor of government and head of the Department of Government at Mills College's, editor of the book Demystifying Syria and author of the upcoming Global Security Watch, Syria. Amir Al-Azam is associate professor of Middle East History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio. And Professor Al-Azam, there's a meeting coming up in Morocco. No military commanders from the Free Syrian Army are going to be there, though.
You mean the current meeting that just occurred?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just adding on to what Professor Lawson said, I mean, it's, you know, quite interesting to see that. I mean, the first thing I would say is that, you know, the U.S. government helped create this, the new Frankenstein, if you want, by stitching him together. And now you've got to show him some love, precisely. I mean, I think...
Well, I remember Mary Shelley's novel, The Love Didn't Work Necessarily.
No, I know. But that's the problem. And the love didn't really work, exactly. And that's what you have. Because ultimately, in attempting to disassociate yourself from the previous entity, the SNC, the Syrian National Council, you basically push for this new entity, which is now being called SOC. I think that's the acronym that everybody uses around. And the Syrian Opposition Coalition, and so but you know, almost 40% of those found in this new coalition are ex-SNC, are SNC members. All the entire senior leadership of the SNC is now part of the new SOC, the SOC, and so the problems have just transferred themselves across. And I think one of the reasons why they were very keen, and if you notice, there was a lot of pressure on the opposition in Marrakesh or leading up to Marrakesh as well to come out with a transitional government, because they realize that this coalition is a fragile coalition. They realize that there are already differences between them, and that this coalition, it could easily fall apart, and that its honeymoon with the people inside, with themselves, is slowly petering out. And unless they come out with a technocratic transitional government that is, if you want, a little bit removed from the what I would call the opposition political circus, then they're going to have problems with this, and they're going to have problems with representation, particularly if you need a credible body that is going to somehow be able to enter into negotiations as the military situation on the ground shifts into a more critical phase, and possibly you start to see some sense of change with the regime itself. I mean, we heard that Bogdanov today issued a statement saying that for the first time they think it might the Syrian regime and the Assad regime might fall. I mean, certainly this is significant.
Well, it's also significant that in recent weeks, just reading in the New York Times, the opposition has developed a series of coalitions and statements on education, on health, on judicial matters, security issues, and so forth. But as you say, they have no transitional government in place. They don't have a cabinet. They don't have a prime minister. I mean, and yet President Obama has said this is an inclusive organization. I mean, that key word, Fred Lawson.
Well, there seems to be, to me, a real paradox in this new organization. The old Syrian National Council was heavily influenced by the Muslim Brothers, but the council made a great effort to look inclusive and had a university professor from France serve as its first chairman, succeeded by a Christian, succeeded by a Kurd. So the old Syrian National Council, tried to present a united front to the outside world. This new organization that claims to be so much more inclusive has as its head a quite virulent Islamist leader from Damascus, someone whose own speeches and own writings don't look terribly moderate if we read them carefully. And we owe Professor Asad Abu Khalil of Cal State Stanislaus credit for looking at these speeches carefully and showing that there's a whole range of very extreme statements that this leader has made in the past. Now, perhaps people can change their minds, and perhaps this new organization is as moderate as the Obama administration would like it to be, but there does seem to be a real paradox that the new organization may be even more uncompromising and militant than the old one.
Let me extend the invitation to you, our listeners, to join this conversation. We're talking about Syria and the Syrian opposition coalition being recognized as a legitimate representative of the Syrian people against Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria. If you'd like to join the program, if you have questions or comments, we certainly welcome you, and our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the program by phone. 866-733-6786 is the number for your calls. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page, or communicate with us by Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And Professor Al-Azim, how does Iran fit into this whole picture as you see it?
Well, the Iranians have been strong supporters of the regime. They've also been their mentors, and they also have a huge stake in the survival of the regime, clearly, and have provided both physical and technical assistance to the regime throughout. But I think right now the Iranians must be also revising their calculus. I mean, if you think about it, for the Iranians, if we try to rank their order of priority, Hezbollah is their number one priority, and then the Syrian regime, and then maybe Hamas or the Gaza and so on and so forth. So for them, they must be looking at, okay, if the Syrian regime falls, how's this going to impact our main ally, our critical ally, Hezbollah, and how do we then offset this loss, and what do we need to do to ensure or to minimize any damage any impact that the loss of the regime could have. That said, I don't think that the Iranians have yet quite reached the situation in their mind where they see that the regime is hopelessly sort of lost. They still think that this is containable. They probably still think that this is something that they can maybe in the it's going to be protracted, but that they can salvage something out of that. In part because remember this: yes, the opposition has made some spectacular gains on the ground, but no single major city has fallen yet. If you think of major cities, Aleppo, Homs, Hama, Idlib, Damascus, Deraa, Deir ez-Zor, the coastal cities of Tartus and Latakia, you know, they may be surrounded. There's a lot of fierce fighting going around on the peripheries, on the edges. You know, the regime still holds anything between 30 and 40% of Aleppo. The regime still holds the core of Damascus and has still very important uncommitted reserves in Damascus. So I think in the mindset of the Iranians and probably the top, you know, the inner circle of the regime, they haven't quite yet reached that tipping point where they think all is lost, we've got to sort of move on.
Professor Lawson, Fred Lawson.
And besides the Iranian government, there are Iranian people and Iranian business people who have made investments in Syria. There are Iranian religious pilgrims who travel to an important Shi'i religious site outside Damascus. And
who
the
do
Iranians,
not want to see Sunni control.
And do not want to see, yes.
Yeah, let me get a quick call on here. Let me go to as many of you as we can. Bruce, we'll start with you. Hi.
Good morning. Actually, I think that things are going about the way they should in Syria. Here we have a dictatorship, a tyrannical government. The people are rising up against them. They're trying to replace him. And along the way, you know, they're going to be presented with certain options, some of them not as good as we'd like, some of them as good as we'd like. But we need to let the people decide and pay the price, right or wrong, make the mistakes that they need to make so that they can evolve. I really congratulate the American government, the Obama administration, for kind of laying low on this one and kind of what wait-and-see approach, because the tendency of America is to get involved, support tyrannical regimes in favor of a variety of concessions and strategic alliances. And this is actually good. It might be not as ideal for the Syrian people, and it's a long road to hoe, but, you know, this is what they need to do in order to get to where they ultimately need to be, which is a free and democratic people.
All right, sir. We thank you for that editorial comment. Response from either of our guests? Fred Lawson?
Well, my sympathies do lie in that direction. But the Syrian people in Aleppo and the Syrian people out in the countryside are suffering pretty horribly, and winter is coming on. And if there were some way to ease the suffering of the local population while at the same time keeping hands off to allow forces to fight it out on the ground, that would be even better.
Let me bring another caller on here. We go to you, Servi. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. So I'm a computer engineer, so I think in terms of computers. Anytime we have a very, we need to restart a system, we use something called a bootstrap program. So my question is, why doesn't, when we go and help a country, start with something called a bootstrap constitution, essentially a default constitution framed by the United Nations, that whose whole purpose is to start a new constitution in the country, you know, essentially equal participation and everything, and then these people come and start the constitution.
Well, so I'm not trying to be facetious here, but Amir al-Azam, they're trying.
We already have one. Actually.
We have one in Egypt, for example.
Yeah, but we already have a default constitution as well. It's the 1952 constitution of Syria, which is what we're going to be defaulting back to. And that's why, if you notice, the Syrian uprising changed its flag. It uses the old green and white and black flag, and that's related to the 1950 constitution. But I think what is more important, and I think something that your caller sort of brought attention, is the planning. What happens the day after? What happens, you know, after the regime falls? Is there a plan in place? Is there a strategy in place? And planning for something like that has to begin well before The collapse of the regime. And in fact, many of us have been working on this for quite some time. I mean, I myself and a group of like-minded people have been working on what we call the Day After Project. It's a project supported by USIP and United States Institute for Peace and by, a variety of other countries. And we've had expertise from across the world come and help us put some of these issues together. So it's not like we've neglected this. So he's right. You need something to fill the void. You need something to fill the vacuum. Otherwise, and something credible and something functional. Otherwise, bad things will fill a vacuum.
Well, if you're talking about planning for tomorrow, we're a serious concern. I'm wondering what your response is or what Fred Lawson's response is to listener's comment. Listener named Ramin says, would partitioning Syria be the ultimate outcome? Remember that the boundaries of many Middle Eastern countries have been drawn up artificially by the British. Is this a good point to start thinking about the region as a collection of smaller, more uniform states and adoption of a loose federation of smaller independent states? And, of course, that came up with Iraq because you have all those divisions with the Kurds and so forth in Iraq like you do in Syria. Should we be thinking about this? Should the Syrians be thinking about this, Fred Laws?
Experiments to partition Syria go all the way back to the founding of the country when the French came in to Syria after the First World War. The French decided to set up separate states for the Alawi community and for the Druze community in the south. And Syrian nationalists have consistently pushed for a more unified, a stronger, a more coherent Syrian state instead of the kind of small, weak countries that would be unable to protect the Syrian people in this neighborhood.
Want to comment here, if you would,
yes,
Professor Alamson?
I mean, I think this may happen in the short term as part of the, if the civil war continues and basically becomes more intense, then there could be a sort of what you might call Balkanization of Syria for a while, or a Lebanization, if you want, where you have a split into different, the East Beirut, West Beirut, or sort of, so you might have an Alawi enclave that tries to hold out for itself, but it's non-sustainable, and I think once the hostilities are over, once some sort of transition process comes into play, people will want to, people won't want this to continue. And also, Syria is too intermixed. The amount of ethnic cleansing they would have to go through in order to purge these areas, in order to make them into the sort of kind of partitioned zones that you're thinking of, would be horrific. The human cost would be unimaginable.
Fred Lawson.
And I think what really matters is that after the fighting, the different communities feel secure. The Alawis feel secure, the Kurds feel secure, the Druze feel secure. And that may not be a goal
that's a big
that can
order.
Be achieved by splitting the country up.
As I said, a big order there. Well, we will continue to watch Syria. We have time for one more call. Let's try it. Get you on here quickly, Sukrit.
Yeah, hi, good morning. My name is Sukrit. I'm calling from Oakland. I'm Arabic, originally from Tunisia.
Yes, sir. Could you go quickly because we're almost out of time?
I am so sorry. All I want to say is pretty much is what Obama did, it was great, but then we need to look at the human side of the story. There's thousands of people. They don't have no shelter. We need to help them with food. We need to help them with the resources.
Well, we thank you for that. And we thank our guests, Fred Lawson, Amir Al-Azam. We're coming up in another hour. We're going to decidedly shift gears in the hour ahead and talk with Calvin Trillin, who will be our guest. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.